Susan, thanks so much for joining us.
I'm happy to be here.
So I want to start with this photo project that the Spectator recently published. Tell us about Left Behind. What was it, and what was the inspiration behind the project?
Left Behind came about after a very long feature story that I published a few months ago. That was a story about a young woman named Nicole Patnode. She was 20 years old and mentally ill. And she jumped off a bridge onto Highway 403 in Hamilton and took her own life. And the story that I wrote looked at her death, but more importantly, her life and her struggles and her family's amazing willingness to share their story. That piece touched a lot of people. I had a huge, huge reaction from readers after the story appeared. And many of those people wanted to share their own stories about suicide. Lots of people who had lost loved ones to suicide wanted suddenly to tell their stories. And I couldn't possibly tell each of those stories, and definitely not in the same in-depth way that I had told Nicole's story. That story took months and months of work. But I felt really compelled to find a way to share those stories. And that's how the idea for the Left Behind project came about.
And why did families say they wanted to take part in a project like this?
You know, everybody had different reasons, but the most common one I heard was so that other families who are struggling with issues of mental illness and suicide knew that they weren't alone. They would know that other families were grieving as well and had gone through this. So that was very, very powerful. But there were also, you know, people who wanted to share their stories because they wanted us to know the person they'd lost. They wanted us to know how remarkable they were, how funny they were, how brilliant they were, how loved they were. So people each came with their own reasons, but they were all, I think, inspired by the need to tell their stories, the need to share their experience with the public.
And were there any stories that particularly resonated with you?
Oh gosh, they all did. I have to say, I did this project with Spectator photojournalist Gary Yokoyama, and we did a number of sessions where we simply put out a call to the public and said, you know, we're setting up a pop-up studio in the Spectator's auditorium. We'll be there on these days at these times. Come share your photos and stories with us. And I think I was in tears constantly through that whole process. Everybody who came in touched my heart. There was one woman who was about the 1 year anniversary of the death of her husband. She happened to be about the same age as me, so I think that resonated with me. She brought in his kilt. He was a Scotsman who participated in Highland Games, and she came in just because he was such a cool guy that she wanted us to know about him, and she wanted to share her husband with everyone. There was another family who was parents and a son, and they had lost their teenage daughter to suicide. And they told me that it had happened in July. And I thought that they meant July of 2016. And I said, oh gosh, so you've just, you know, had the anniversary. And they said, no, like, she died just a few weeks ago. And I couldn't believe that they were already thinking about sharing their story and the ability it might have to heal or help another family.
And so what you have here essentially is 36 stories of suicides which didn't make it into the papers, or maybe they received only cursory coverage. Do you think that the people who complete suicide and their loved ones are being done a disservice by the news with the attention that they aren't getting?
I don't think any of them had been covered in my newspaper except for one, and that was Nicole Patnode. Her mother came and participated in the Left Behind Project, so we had written that story. And I also just want to say that the purpose of the Left Behind Project wasn't to focus on the suicide. It was to focus on the lives that were lost. In fact, we never talked at all about how any of those people died. You know, I don't know that we need to write about every suicide. And in fact, on a very practical level, as harsh as it may sound, it's impossible to write about every suicide. Our newspaper would have that kind of coverage, you know, almost every day. So that's unfortunate. I think there is a time and a place for stories about suicide. I have never written a story about a suicide without the permission of the family. If I'm going to use names, if I'm going to write any kind of a substantial story with any kind of detail, I need to do it with the blessing and cooperation of the family. That's not a spectator policy. That's my policy. That's how I like to do these stories. And I have written quite a few of these over the years, and each is for a different reason. You know, I have another story that will be in the Spectator soon, another one about suicide that focuses on different aspects of our healthcare system and brings out some different issues that I haven't written about before. So it's not writing about suicide for the sake of writing about suicide or so that we can say we've covered all of them. It's about what can we learn from this? What's the story here? And what is the family hoping that the story might do?
And you were saying that you go over the story with the families before it goes to print, and you try to get their blessing.
Right. I would want the family to be on board with me at the very beginning of the process of reporting and writing a story like that. The stories that I've done on suicide have been long-term projects. They've been investigative pieces. They've been big. And in each of those cases, the family has worked with me for weeks, if not months, so that I understand the person at the center of the story. But my own personal policy when it comes to sharing details, most newspapers, any newspaper I've worked for, has a policy that is you can't show your story to anybody before it's published, anybody outside of the newsroom. And so I don't. I've never handed a copy of my story over to anybody. But on sensitive stories, I will routinely go over the story in a lot of detail with the people involved in it so that, for a few reasons. One is so that there are no surprises, that they don't open the newspaper and are shocked by what they read. They'll know everything before it hits the paper. It's also for accuracy. You know, if I've made a mistake, I want to be able to correct it before it's published. So it's a great way of fact checking for me as well.
Have you ever run into an instance where someone was hesitant to give their blessing to the article, maybe because they didn't like what it said about them?
Yeah, sure, that's happened. That happens on all kinds of stories, suicide or otherwise. And it is a fine line. I'm not writing a story in the hopes that the person I'm writing about loves every bit of it. I have an obligation to be fair, but also to be honest and accurate. And sometimes that means writing things that the people in my story or their families might not want to hear. I write about tough stuff, and that can include, you know, facing some of the harsh realities about the people I'm writing on. But I think in my experience, if I have an honest discussion with people and explain to them why I've chosen to include those sorts of details in my story, I like to think that when I include those details, I do it in a responsible way and in a respectful way. people usually understand what it's all about. They might not like it at first, but after some discussion, we can usually get around to it. But that's not always the case. I have had times when people have been upset or angry at me for what I've written, for, you know, one sentence in a long, long story. And that bothers me when that happens. But that's also the reality of being a journalist.
Just in general, so many journalists and papers avoid writing about suicide just as a blanket, either informal or formal policy. Why is it important to you that these kind of stories do get told?
Well, there was a time when newspapers just didn't write about suicide, period. And we've come a long way since that. I've seen it change a lot in my own career. And I've always pushed back and felt very strongly that there are good reasons for writing about suicide. You know, how are we going to fix this? How are we going to understand this? How are we going to improve mental health care and suicide prevention if we don't talk about it? If we don't acknowledge that it exists, if we don't break down the stigma that's involved with mental illness, that says these are our taboo subjects that we shouldn't talk about. There is no shame in mental illness, and I don't think that there's any shame in suicide either. These are people who, in the vast majority of cases, have an illness. And why are we shying away from that? You know, and I think society as a whole is becoming more open and honest about the issue. And I think journalism has come a long way. Are we all the way there yet? No, we're not. But I think my newsroom for sure and other newsrooms are definitely having important conversations and debates and sometimes heated arguments about how to cover this stuff, when to cover it, how to cover it, and why we're covering it.
Is there anything in particular in terms of changes in suicide reporting in Canada, apart from just the willingness to report? What have you seen change in the reporting over your career?
That's a good question. I now get people asking me to do these stories about their family members. That didn't happen 25 years ago. When I started my career, I could talk someone into doing a story like that. I could approach them and ask them and explain to them why I wanted to do it. And oftentimes they would. But now people are coming to me and asking for their stories to be told. And I think that's huge. I think that says so much about their comfort level with sharing their message publicly. You know, having said that, though, I think it's interesting that even some of the families that I've written about, when you read the obit in the paper, you know, we still shy away from the word suicide, right? It's died suddenly or died by mental illness is a phrase I hear sometimes. We seem to still have a bit of a stigma around that word suicide.
I don't know whether you remember, but like, when was the first time someone came to you and said, I would like you to tell this story?
The first one that came to me was a woman named Sharon Jones, and her husband, Roy, was a Hamilton police officer who died by suicide. And I covered his suicide when it happened. He took his own life while on duty. He drove to a park in Hamilton and used his service weapon and shot himself. And when Roy died, I wrote a very short story about his death and did not name him in the story. I knew who he was. I knew his name, but I had not been able to connect with his family. And so a decision was made by myself and my editors that we would write it without naming him. And it was, there wasn't a lot of detail in that story. On the 10th anniversary, sorry, I believe it was the 5th anniversary of his suicide, his widow called me. I had never spoken to her before. We had never talked. And she called me and said, I think it's time for me to tell Roy's story. And that was significant for me in a lot of ways. It was, first of all, the first time I had done a long, in-depth story about a police officer suicide. I've done others since. But at the time that Roy had died, Hamilton police were very angry with the Spectator for writing anything at all about his suicide. And I got messages from the chief of police and others within the service telling me to back off, that it was nobody's business. Police officers canceled their subscription to the Spectator. And then here we are 5 years later, and the very woman that they thought that they were protecting comes to me and says she wants to tell her story. So that was a real pivotal moment for me, that a police officer's wife was willing to share her story. It was a real clear message to police officers in general. And her point in wanting to tell Roy's story was very much that police officers work in a culture that is different from most others. And she wanted officers to know, and their families to know, that if you need help, get it. And there's no clearer example of what happens when you don't than what happened to Roy Jones. And that story that I wrote went on to win a national newspaper award, which I also found, I found satisfying in a lot of ways. But, you know, here I work in this industry, in this culture that for a long time had said, don't write about suicides. And now a story about a suicide won a national newspaper award.
And you have written, you have covered more than one police officer's suicide. What makes it more challenging than reporting on civilians' suicide?
It goes back again to that police culture. Although it's that culture is changing a lot. Traditionally, it has been, you know, what happens with police officers should stay amongst police officers. It's part of their policing family and it should be kept private. Police officers have traditionally felt that they need to be warriors, that they need to be always strong, that they need to be, above any kind of almost above any kind of flaw. And mental illness has always been seen in the policing culture as a flaw. You know, it's difficult because while police leaders are saying that they want to deal with this issue and that they want to be supportive of officers who need help, there is the reality that a police officer with mental health issues, it can infect their job. It can mean that they're taken off the street or that they're, you know, assigned to other duties. So it's difficult, and we've gone a long way towards making changes. And I think stories like the one about Roy Jones has been a contributing factor to that.
And there's also other kinds of stigma, like the way that the police force treats a death by suicide.
There is. I can speak for Hamilton Police. If an officer dies by suicide, whether they are on duty or off duty at Hamilton Police, there is no formal police funeral. I think we've all seen images of police funerals where there's a procession, where there's an honor guard, where people attend in uniform, where there's a lot of pomp and circumstance. And that has to be approved by the chief of police. And in each of those cases in Hamilton, I've written about, one, two, three, four, at least four Hamilton police suicides. In none of those cases have they been given a formal police funeral.
And stepping back outside the police force, what kind of resistance do you face in reporting frankly about suicides?
Anytime I write a story about suicide, I do get blowback from the public. I'm encouraged by the fact, though, that the balance has shifted. When I wrote stories about suicide earlier in my career, I would say that most readers were resentful of it and critical of it. And now it has tipped in the other direction. When I wrote the story about Nicole Patineau, who jumped off the bridge, the positive feedback was unbelievable. The feedback in general was enormous. I don't know that I've ever written anything that's had such a huge reaction from readers. But the vast, vast majority of it was positive. I will say that one suicide prevention group from Kitchener-Waterloo, I believe, thought that I shouldn't have written it at all, and cited journalism guidelines about reporting on suicide, and basically thought that that story should never have been told. I just disagree. And you know, I've heard all those arguments. I've sat down and talked with people about you know, the others will be encouraged to take their own lives, the copycat suicides, that it's glamorizing suicide, all that sort of stuff. And I don't buy it, and I don't agree with it. And I'm lucky that I have a newspaper that supports me when I write these stories.
And even with a non-police officer suicide, the police themselves are also hesitant to talk to reporters about deaths by suicide. Isn't that right?
It's true. I think what you may be referring to is when I was starting out on the Nicole Patineau story. It was impossible to get police to be clear about what had happened to her. Nicole jumped off a bridge onto one of the busiest highways that makes its way through Hamilton, and she did it at rush hour, causing thousands and thousands of motorists to come to a standstill. It backed up traffic for hours and hours around the city. So Hamilton people were very aware that something had happened that day. And that's really where this story all began from. It was a very public suicide. And in a strange turn of events, one of our photographers, photojournalist Barry Gray, actually wound up on top of the bridge that Nicole had jumped from before police ever got there. He just was looking for a vantage point to take a picture of the traffic backed up on the highway, and he found Nicole's shoes and her sweater sitting on that bridge. And he immediately knew that what had happened here, that this was someone who jumped. However, police in their official news release said that it was a pedestrian who had been struck by a vehicle, which I suppose that's true, but that wasn't really what happened. It wasn't that she was walking across the street and was struck by a truck. She jumped in front of that truck. So we had the head start because of the observations of our photographer. And then, of course, I found Nicole's obit in our own newspaper a couple of days later and put two and two together. But I didn't want to go straight to the family. I was trying to avoid that. I was trying to be sensitive and careful about my dealings with the family. So I went to the OPP, who were in charge of that accident scene, that death, and asked, can you confirm if this was a suicide? And they would not. They refused to do that. So I asked, could you talk to the family and ask the family if you can confirm to me that it was a suicide? And the officer said that, yes, he would do that. But I found out later, after waiting and not getting any response from police, and by now I had contacted the Patineau family and told them what I was hoping to do. You know, by the way, the Patino family said, thank you for contacting us. We are so pleased that you did. You're the only person who's contacted us. We felt like nobody cared about Nicole. And yes, we'd be happy to tell you her story. So it was when I was sitting at the kitchen table in the Patino house and they were, you know, bringing out all their photos of Nicole and sharing their stories of Nicole. It was only then that I learned that the OPP had never asked them if for permission to release publicly the fact that it was a suicide. And when I told Nicole's mother, Carol, the story about the OPP, she was very angry. Very angry. She said, why are they making decisions for me? Why is it up to them to decide? You know, why didn't they ask me? And then I could make up my own mind about whether I wanted it released or not. So that was interesting because I think it's very difficult for journalists to approach a family. We never know what the reaction is going to be. But that was a reminder that that there are families who want to talk and want to share their stories, and maybe a good lesson for police as well.
What duty do you think journalists have in particular in changing this culture of silence about suicide?
I think we have a duty to tell stories, to give families a voice. You know, I think I said earlier that there is no shame in mental illness. There's no shame in suicide. And those actually aren't my words. Those are words that I've stolen from Carol Patino. And she said that to me the first time that we met. I was so moved by that. I learned so much from her saying that to me. Her daughter was ill, and why should her family be embarrassed by that in any way? And if telling Nicole's story can help somebody else, then it wasn't all in vain. So asking if we can tell the stories and telling them, I think it's that simple for journalists and telling it in a responsible way, remembering why we're telling the story, that we're not telling a story so that we can all hear the sordid details of a terrible death, telling the story so that we can help those who are living and remember the person that we've lost.
So in fulfilling that duty, what should reporters be mindful of when they're trying to report responsibly on suicide?
I do try to emphasize the life lived rather than the method of suicide. Having said that, sometimes the method of suicide is a really important part of the story. For example, one of the Hamilton police officers that I wrote about who died by suicide snuck his police gun home with him and used it to take his own life. And that raised questions about safety and about, you know, how police lock their guns up at the end of a shift and how they're accounted for and that sort of thing. So in that case, I think there were important issues raised and lessons to be learned from how he took his life. I think it is important to always include in stories methods of help, ways people can get help. So anytime I write about suicide, you'll see some kind of a fact box that goes with it, with helpline numbers and you know, pointing to websites and that sort of thing where people can go for help. I think it's important to include the family whenever possible. In my experience, again, the families have lived through a lot before they even get to the point of the suicide. They have struggled to find help. They have struggled to understand. They have struggled to cope with what's going on with their loved one. And there are lots of lessons to be learned there as well. So I think, you know, being open-minded, trying to see it from all different views. I've worked with a lot of families who are very angry at our healthcare system for not being there, for not being able to save their loved one. But I've also spent lots and lots of time talking to doctors and hospitals about the challenges they face. So this isn't about blame. Maybe that's the biggest lesson to take out of this for journalists. These don't have to be stories that say, here's where it all went wrong and here's who to blame. These are really complicated stories. I don't think nobody I've written about has died by suicide because of one certain thing. It's about a whole bunch of things, a whole bunch of issues. And I think making improvements also is about complicated things and fixing a lot of things and looking at a lot of issues.
Could you comment on the concerns of language when you're reporting on suicide?
Sure. I think you and I have both been very careful about our language around this. You will not hear me say committed suicide. And I would hope that other journalists aren't using that phrase anymore either. Committed suicide goes back to a time when suicide was a crime. And just as, you know, you commit a crime, you committed suicide. So changing it to died by suicide, I think using the language that that families find appropriate and that doctors find appropriate, I think is really important. And if in doubt, I ask family members, what terms do you use? What terms are you comfortable with? And sometimes, I'll even have a paragraph or two in my story that explains why I'm using certain terms. So I think that is very important, but also not shying away from the word suicide. You know, talking about sudden deaths or died by mental illness. I know that's a popular one, but as a journalist, that one doesn't work for me because I just don't think it's accurate. I think suicide is simple and clear and explains the situation.
When you're reporting on just tragedy after tragedy, because you're a crime reporter in general.
Right. I'm a columnist. Yeah.
How do you look after yourself and your own mental health and emotional health?
That's a good question because, journalists are terrific at writing about or reporting on PTSD and vicarious trauma for first responders and for military and for jurors at murder trials or even judges and lawyers. I mean, we write those stories all the time, but we are far less likely to turn the spotlight on ourselves and think about the impact that all these stories have in a newsroom. Journalists will acknowledge that reporters who are foreign correspondents or war correspondents might suffer from PTSD. We'll go that far. But rarely, I think, do we talk about the impact that covering murder trials or covering suicides or fatal car accidents or fires has on a reporter. So, I've been covering that kind of stuff day in and day out for 25 years. So I do try and take care of myself. I do have family and friends and colleagues that I can talk to when I need to. My husband is, we met at journalism school. He's trained as a journalist. So I'm lucky that he gets what I do for a living and is always there for me when I've had a tough day. I've been very lucky to have some editors along the way who have also just understood what a rough day in a courtroom can be like. And my longtime city editor, who has now left The Spectator, but her name was Carla Emerata, and Carla herself was a court reporter before she became my city editor. And so she really understood. And, there were times when I'd call her from my office at the courthouse and just have a little cry. And she always understood that and was there to listen and to and to ask if I was okay. Some of the best people I've had in my life to turn to when I've had a rough day covering this kind of stuff are police officers, particularly some friends I have who are homicide officers or former homicide officers. And, you know, they really get it because they've lived this stuff too, right? And, you know, I have to say, we don't have a lot of tell me about your feelings kinds of conversations, but they will be the first ones to say, hey, I think you need to go out for a beer. Let's go out for a beer and blow off some steam and just cheer me up and be a friend when I need it. So it is a weird world to work in, and only a select number of people have had that same experience, and homicide officers are some of them. Lawyers too, you know, criminal lawyers and crown attorneys also really get it. So I do have lots of people in my life I can turn to. It's also just about taking care of yourself physically. You know, when I do a long homicide trial, those are tough, and they are exhausting, and they can go on for months of, you know, I'm regularly working 12 or 14 or 16 hour days when I'm doing homicide trials. So just remembering to eat, trying to get a good night's sleep, trying to squeeze in some exercise when I can. That's all about, you know, self-care and preserving my mental health. And finally, you know, I've done this a long time, so I know myself, and I have gotten into the habit of, at the end of every long homicide trial I cover, I take a few days off. You know, after the verdict, I book myself off for a few days so that I can just be at home and hang out with my family, who probably hasn't seen me for a while, and just think about things other than what I heard and saw in the courtroom.
How have things changed over your career in terms of institutional support?
Well, there wasn't any when I started, like, period. They're just, it didn't exist. And I don't, for at least the first 10 years, maybe longer of my career, I don't remember anybody in my newsrooms ever asking me how I am or there was just no acknowledgement at all that this stuff can be hard to cover. So there's still not a whole lot of that, I have to say. We don't in any way routinely check in with reporters in my newsroom. It's not just me, you know, it's others in my newsroom who cover police. And also, you know, our health reporter at the Hamilton Spectator, probably next to me, she covers the most death. She's often writing about people who have died of terrible illnesses and who are fighting for their lives. So she writes a lot of hard stories as well. And nobody checks in regularly. Having said that, there is help available to anybody, any Hamilton Spectator employee who needs some counseling or therapy, that is offered to us through our employer. I think we're still reluctant to take it, though, take that help.
Just speaking personally, when you do something like the Nicole Patnode story and you're trying to convey to readers what her experiences were like, I don't think I would feel qualified to try and tell that kind of very personal interior story about someone else. But at some point, you just have to do something like that. What advice do you have for someone facing that?
You know, when you're trying to get inside somebody's head, you're right. I mean, the journalist isn't the best qualified person for that, but the family is. And, you know, I spent hours and hours and hours with the Patnode family on numerous occasions. I went back to them over and over and over again, listening to their stories about Nicole, asking questions, and maybe most importantly, asking them, you know, what do I need to know? You tell me what's important and what I need to have to get a better understanding of Nicole. You know, it's no different from any other part of journalism, which is we're not the experts, you know. Even though I've been writing about crime in court for 25 years, I always make a point of saying if I'm being interviewed by journalists about a case I'm covering or something like that, I always make a point of saying, look, I'm not a lawyer, I'm not the expert, but I can tell you what they've told me. I can tell you what they've taught me. You know, it's being humble and realizing that as a journalist, we don't have all the answers, and making sure that we give the family members, in the case of suicide, or the doctors, or whoever else is involved, the police, that we really hear what they're having to say, and that we reflect that in the stories that we tell.
All right. Thanks so much for coming in and talking to us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.